You're listening to the Ask Drone You podcast. You ask, we answer your drone questions. Whether you're here to turn your passion into profit or you simply fly for fun, we're a community of learners and teachers who aspire to achieve greatness. We are
Drone You.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another awesome episode of Ask Drone You. My name is Paul, and I have the pleasure of having Mr. Chris Voss with me. If you're not familiar with Chris Voss, he wrote the book Never Split the Difference, which you've heard me talk about significantly on the show about how important it is to really learn and master negotiating skills. Utilizing the tips and tricks that Mr. Voss gives you by utilizing empathetic statements, calibrated questions, and information to truly get on the same emotional, intellectual level with your counterpart. These skills are not only important for negotiating, but they're also important for life, and in my opinion, for sales, because for me, negotiating is a game. And if you want to master that game, I think Mr. Voss is the number one person to learn from. Mr. Voss, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Paul. A pleasure to be here with you.
Well, no, sir, the pleasure is really all mine. I'm really excited to have you on the show. Can you give us a brief history of where you've been and how you've come to the place that you are today?
I was born and I live here now.
It sounds like a very succinct story.
There you go. That's a good label. Now, you know, I'm a small town boy from Iowa. I grew up in Iowa. Became the FBI's lead international kidnapping negotiator. Blue collar background, working class, small town. Can do, open to learning, follow the path.
I like
up to Interstate 80, made a right.
I like that. I like how you snuck something in there, really, though. You said, I was always open to learning, lifelong learner. I think that that's really important for people to be successful, because we may think that we're the best at whatever we do, but if we're not willing to learn, then how are we ever going to become better?
Yeah, and everybody pays lip service to being willing to learn, but not everybody is. I mean, it's actually a skill that you can test for. It's called openness. And there's a psychological instrument out there called the FFI, five-factor inventory, and openness is one of the things that they test for. Paul, let me ask you a question. What's your browser on your laptop?
It's Chrome.
What's your browser on your phone?
Chrome.
All right, so if you were to read Adam Grant's book, Originals. And what makes an original? An original is someone who has a high degree of openness. And he talks in the very first part of this book, by the way, read anything Adam Grant's written. He's a brilliant guy. He says, find out what somebody's browser is.
And why is that important?
What's your default browser on your laptop?
Safari.
You switched out. You didn't take what was there. You took a couple extra steps to put in the Google Chrome browser. You did the same thing on your phone. You bypassed what you were given and you added in some extra. So it's an indicator, a quick, fast, down and dirty indicator of your level of openness is what your browser. Now, this horrified me when I read this, because while I had put Chrome on all my laptops, I didn't have it on my iPhone. So I quick went into my iPhone and put Chrome in because I didn't want anybody to find out that I've been using Safari.
So now that you know all these tests, do you have your own little tactics to make sure people can't figure out the same? Is it FFI?
FFI.
FFI.
Figure it out. Why don't you want people to figure it out? What makes you not want to figure it out?
Because maybe you don't want to have a label put on you. Because if someone can figure out what you react to, what negative leverage you react to, what positive leverage you react to, wouldn't you say that that person has some sort of power over you?
Ah, it's a fear-driven question, and you're worried about having labels. Now, a label can either be the beginning of a discussion or it's the end of a discussion. We get into that occasionally because we believe that the world breaks down into three default types. Doesn't matter what your gender or your ethnicity is, but you're going to fall into one of three categories. And it's the old caveman days, fight, flight, or make friends. What did the cavemen that survived, you know, what was their reaction to threat? Fight, flight, or make friends? And these fall into what we refer to as the assertive, the accommodator, or the analyst. Now, that should be the beginning of your discussion, not the end of it. And if things like this are the beginning of your discussion, which means you're still open to hearing some more, then that's a good thing. But if you categorize people and that's the end of your discussion, then that's a bad thing because you're going to miss opportunities.
Gotcha. That's really interesting. Let's take a step back. Let's give everyone an overview of why your negotiation tactics are so powerful. Do you mind giving us just a quick step-by-step breakdown of exactly what makes a master negotiator?
Well, just effort. Now, if you're not particularly open, you can still get there with effort. You're just, it's just going to take longer. And, you know, I suppose that's why, you know, I was half there and half not there. I mean, I don't think of myself as particularly a fast learner, but I work really hard at it. I stay at it to try to learn the lessons. I mean, the environment that I was raised in was a figure it out environment. What we're talking about in these skills is emotional intelligence. You know, these are hostage negotiators had to learn how to apply emotional intelligence before the phrase was even invented. We had to get in the middle of negotiations that succeeded strictly on the basis of emotional intelligence. Now, the old question as to whether or not this applies to everything else or not, I'll draw an analogy. Everybody knows about the criminal profilers from the FBI, you know, made famous by the TV show Criminal Minds.
Okay.
Which, by the way, a good friend of mine writes for, and he was an FBI profiler. So the FBI profilers, they started out with the theory that criminal behavior is just human behavior. It's not special because it's criminal, it's just human behavior. And then they said, okay, if we can follow this line of thinking, this hypothesis, then the most intense form of criminal behavior is homicide. So let's start to look for parallels in homicide and see if that applies to all criminal behavior and then life in general. Well, they ran the experiment, they found that it was true. So what we found out is hostage negotiations, hostage taking is just intense negotiation. But the human dynamics, because human beings are involved, apply it to all negotiations. Now, I originally started with that as a hypothesis. Then when I ended up at Harvard Law School, going through their course on negotiation, I'm the only FBI agent to ever have done that, which is a stupid thought because all I did was ask. Like half the time, it's amazing what you can get just by asking. So I asked.
But I thought that your boss gave you a hard time about going to that. Isn't that right? That like at the last day or the day before, he had given you a hard time about going there. And you, it's one of the lessons in your book, and it's spacing me right now.
And what happened? And so he gave me a hard time. Did I go anyway?
Yes.
So I must have negotiated my way back in. Huh?
I guess it does just start with asking.
Well, and then the structure of what you ask. So I remember that interaction with my boss like it was yesterday. So I'm working for a control freak boss, and I'm a natural born assertive. You know, the fight, flight, make friends types. I'm a natural fighter, which I've had to learn the skills from the other two types to make my fight more palatable, if you will. Because you have to assert in negotiations, otherwise you're asking the other side to guess what's good for you. And guesswork has a low percentage of being effective, so you got to be assertive. But anyway, as a natural assertive, I remember one day about a week and a half where I was supposed to go to this training, I spoke to my boss in a tone of voice that caused a look to come across his face that let me know I was insulting him at the moment. I was talking to him like I thought he was stupid. And the look that came across his face made me realize in that moment, you know, he's going to make me pay for this. I know I'm going to pay for this. And sure enough, a couple days later, at the end of the day on Friday, he calls me into his office and starts to question me as to whether or not I ought to be going to this training at Harvard at all. And I'm sitting there thinking like, all right, this is a payback. He's trying to teach me a lesson. So the question that I asked is what we now call the time transport question. And it makes people feel in control, and it makes them feel good. And all I said to him was, when you originally approved this, what did you have in mind? Now, these are open-ended questions, but what I did was I took him out of the moment in time that we were in back to the other moment in time, which was a gentle way of reminding him that he was trying to withdraw permission for something he'd already approved. But I got to remind him of this in a way that doesn't back him into a corner, because that's not going to do me any good. Plus, it makes me seem completely deferential in the moment. And all he really wanted was for me to tell him in some way or another that I remembered that he was in charge. So he sat back in his chair and he relaxed and he made the little steepling thing with his hands where people put their fingers together. You know, they call it steepling, like a church steeple in front of you. What's what people do when they feel powerful and in control. And he leaned back and he went from, why are you going, to, look, when you get back, just make sure you share everything you learned with everybody. And I said, fine, and I was gone. You know, but the illusion of control and making people who want to feel like they're in charge, a great way to get what you want.
And I think it's really important. I mean, that brings me to the first question that I had scheduled, for you, which is that negotiating is inherent, really, with success. And it just strikes me, I mean, I feel like you've really just empowered a lot of people who are employees. Maybe they're not small business owners or owners, or even believe that they can be owners, which I think is a big misfortune amongst the American public. But that being said, I think it empowers a lot of employees, people who may not believe that they can get out there and do all these things themselves. Because part of what is inherent with success is negotiating. And in order to negotiate, you have to sell yourself. You have to provide a service or a product. And you have to do so in a way that's emotionally striking with someone if you're going to be rememberable. And it just makes me think, like, how important it is to be a good negotiator and how important it is to have your set of skills, because how an individual conducts him or herself and the confidence that they display therein are so important. And it makes me wonder, are there any strategies for newer business owners when first getting into these negotiations, into building, the confidence to do this? Because I've seen that a lot of people, and even telling them about your book, who maybe are not assertive, don't even believe that they're, up for the task. And I give the example of my wife. I wrote in here my fiance, but now she's my wife, just got married.
Congratulations. That was a good negotiation on your part. Maybe
hurt. Thank you. I appreciate that. But whenever I bring up negotiating and how I think of it as a game, and I've always thought of it as fun because it's almost like an intellectual game of chess, she always hates it because she thinks it's awkward. It makes the public air tense. So my question is not only how do you build the confidence to negotiate in the terms that you do, but also how do you explain to someone that it's not malicious, it's not nefarious?
Well, it's kind of three real big parts of everything that you just said. So I'm going to see if I can break them out. I mean, it has to do with your comment about the game. It has to do with our mindset that we go through before we get into it. And then the third thing is probably whether or not it's nefarious. So let's start with the game thing. All right. So I got some pretty reliable sources that were 31% smarter in a positive frame of mind. Now, that's no small jump.
Huh.
So if you look at things as a game, you're having fun, and you're in a positive frame of mind, and you're automatically smarter. So if you don't look at it as a game, and it's tedious, or it's to be feared, the flip side's also true. You're automatically dumber. And I suppose to some degree this gets into our misinterpretation of whether or not emotions are good or bad in negotiations. Negative emotions are bad. They make you dumber. Positive emotions are good. They make you smarter. But all negotiations have gotten a bad rap due to the outsized effect the negative emotions have. And, one of the analogies that I like to use, I don't know if there's a good analogy or not. You could tell me. Everybody knows the analogy that on incremental change, you could put a frog, theoretically, you can put a frog in water and slowly raise the temperature to boiling, and a frog won't jump out until it's dead because it doesn't notice the incremental change in temperature. But by the same token, if you drop a frog into really hot water to begin with, they'll jump out if they can. We could take that analogy and say, well, that proves that water is bad for frogs because scalding water killed the frog. Well, it's not that it's the water that was bad, but it was hot water. So it's not that it's emotions that are bad, but it's negative emotions. So the second thing you talked about, which ramps off the negative emotions, is to, how she imagines things to happen to her in advance. We're wired from the caveman days to be overly negative, to be pessimistic. We're naturally wired to see more problems than are actually there. That was necessary when there were really jungle animals in our environment each and every day that might kill us. You know, if you're the optimistic caveman walks by the cave and says, you know, last time we walked by here, there was a bear that came out and ate Steve. But I'm really optimistic, and I'm going to guess there's no bear in this cave, and I'm going to go ahead and go in. Well, that guy got eaten because he kept doing it every time. But the pessimistic guy said, you know what? A bear jumped out of a cave last time around. It looked like this, and now I'm going to stay away from caves for a while until I'm sure that they're empty. Pessimism was necessary for survival. We still got that in our brain. Only this day and age, we're not in an environment that's threatening to us, but we continue to react as if it is, and we beat ourselves before we get to the table. I've heard no shortage of negotiators say, I'm not going to bring that up. That's a non-start. Well, you don't know for sure that it was. And what you just did was you did the other side's job for them before you even got to the table. That's really common.
Very interesting. And then the third part? I don't want to cut you off.
That's all right. Now, the third part. What was the third thing that I said? I remember.
Whether it was nefarious or malicious.
Ah, right. All right. So, great persuasion is only nefarious in the hands of the beholder. Now we're on video, right?
Yes.
All right. What am I holding up here?
A phone. An iPhone 10.
Right. Now, a lot of people use these things to commit crimes with.
True.
It's just a tool.
So what you're saying is you're making the same argument as those who are in counterterrorism with drones, that drones are evil and nefarious and they can carry bombs and C4 over prison walls and help people escape, but in the eyes of someone, it can also save lives and drop parachutes to people and life preservers.
Yeah, a tool by in and of itself becomes a problem only in how it's applied. Now, people should be leery of extremely advanced emotional intelligence skills. And again, Adam Grant, I'll refer to him, I think he wrote a piece called The Dark Side of Emotional Intelligence. And, you know, what a lot of people, empathy is not sympathy. A lot of people want to believe that it is, but it's not. But let's change the definition. The Black Swan Group, we call it tactical empathy. Daniel Goleman calls it cognitive empathy. Same thing. You know who Goleman says the best at using cognitive empathy, the people who are best at it are?
Who?
Sociopaths.
Huh. Interesting.
And why do they use cognitive empathy? Because they're nice or because it works?
Because it works.
It's ridiculously effective. You know, not only does it work, but those guys are lazy.
Yeah.
They don't want to work hard. They want a tool that works really good for them. They don't have to work too hard at it. That's why they pick cognitive empathy or tactical empathy, however you want to define it, because it's ridiculously effective when you wrap your mind around it.
No, that's really powerful. That's really powerful. So one of the other things on top of empathy that you talk about are calibrated questions. And in the beginning of this interview, if not before we started, you asked me some calibrated questions that I actually was a little stumped on because I was like, okay, I really want to try to figure out why he's asking certain questions in a time frame that I can respond to the question as well. And that really wasn't working very well. Because obviously you are the master of calibrated questions. So for those who don't understand what calibrated questions are or why they're so powerful on top of empathy, do you mind explaining it for us?
Well, you kind of explained it just now in that my purpose was not to get an answer. My purpose to ask those questions was to get you to think. And you said just a second ago, I stumped you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Daniel Kahneman would refer to this as slow thinking. Not that you're slow, but slow thinking is critical in-depth thinking. You know, to ask somebody the question, it stops them in their tracks. I mean, and literally, that's true. I mean, you ask somebody a good stop and think question, they're going to stop moving and stop everything out and really focus and give some real serious in-depth thought to the question as posed. Now, there's no real downside to that because I'm trying to trigger a thought process as opposed to get an answer.
Now, why is that powerful? Sorry to interrupt you.
Sure. Well, for our negotiation to be effective, it's got to be collaborative. Now, you come in with preconceived notions, preconceived by definition lacks collaboration. So I got to trigger you back into a collaboration mindset without making you angry, without making you feel cornered, without making you upset, while maintaining your openness. And as evidenced by the great conversation that we are continuing to have, that's what happened.
I love some of your unique characteristics. You kind of can tell where you are from the country, and I really think it's cool. All right, so once we get past calibrated questions and we have a collaborative negotiation, would you say that sometimes these tactics may be more successful with, let's say, 40-plus generation? Because I've been practicing a lot of your tactics, and I really appreciate it. In fact, if you had literally a master's degree in what you write, I'd probably be one of the first takers of the class, because as I hear you talk, it seems like, even though I've read the book so many times, I've listened to it, not read it, by the way, because I retain more that way, but every time I listen to it, I learn something new. And as I have this conversation with you, I realize that there are 10, 100, 1,000 things below what you've already said in your book about negotiating: calibrated questions, empathy, giving you the power, creating a collaborative scenario, talking in your late night FM DJ voice, like everything.
Which is what
fine.
You're doing right now.
Hopefully I got that one down pretty good.
Nice job.
But my question to you is, do you think that these tactics are specific to a type of person, or do you think that they'll work for every generation?
Well, they only work on people that have human brains.
So who are the type of people who have human brains?
Yeah, all of us. It doesn't matter what your age, gender, or ethnicity is, because there's, you know, you have a respiratory system. You know, I'm 60, you're 16. How old are you?
I'll be 30 next month.
All right, so you're a millennial.
Yes.
And I am not. I'm at the tail end of the baby boomer generation.
Really?
But we got the exact same respiratory system, do we not?
True.
Now, I love the respiratory system as an analogy, because it doesn't matter what your age, gender, ethnicity, your respiratory system functions on certain rules. Our emotional system in our brain, and this is the advantage that neuroscience has given us today, our emotional system has organs, the hippocampus, the amygdala, a couple of other parts of it. And it operates very much like the respiratory system in that you can control your emotions for as long as you can hold your breath. So you can say to yourself, calm down, and get completely calm for about as long as you can hold your breath. Then the autopilot's going to kick back in. Now, what gets the bad rap that the millennials get these days is more in their application of emotional intelligence, but not in their susceptibility to it. Now, because they've got everyone of any age, which would include millennials, has a limbic system, the millennials are equally susceptible to it. The shortcoming for millennials would only be in that it's been shown that you get less practice with emotional intelligence via text of the different ways to communicate. There's been some studies that have indicated the actual application, learning curve, interaction of emotional intelligence through text message is the least proficient. So you even get more practice with emails in emotional intelligence than you do in text messaging. So if your emotional intelligence is down, it's only down as a result of practice and having nothing to do with anybody's capacity for it. You have no less or no more than anybody else does.
But if aptitude is down because of our inability to practice, which we know from the 10,000-hour rule that perfect practice makes for a perfect presentation, but I just wonder if there's a gap in aptitude, could there be a gap in the rule system? If I have, for example, let me give you an example. So flying cameras, flying thermal cameras, you can see if someone is on drugs really easily. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. And if I'm able to practice looking through that thermal camera to try to gauge people in a large audience, in a crowd, to see who may be troublesome and who may not be. And it takes me 3 years to run across the 30-year-old lady who's on some sort of, it's one of those medications that essentially sends blood to all of your fingers, your hands, and everything, right? So over the years, I'm having all this practice, but it's not meaningful practice. I finally get the experience 3 years later. I'm just trying to showcase that, experience is one of those things that really teaches people a lot. And if we have a lack of ability to get experience, does that change the rules of the negotiating game?
No, I don't think it does. I mean, some of the most insightful applications of this emotional intelligence-based negotiation that, I'm teaching and my company's teaching. I mean, I've come across some millennials that are just superstars at it, have just blown me away with how smart they are. Now, I've always kind of believed in what people generously say the 80-20 rule is. And the 80-20 rule in terms of performance is that 20% of your population is going to come up with 80% of your results. And I think actually the number that come up with the 80% of your results is less than that. It's maybe 10% of a given population. So maybe different generations are dopey in different ways. But nobody's got the market cornered on dopiness. And every 5 years, a new generation gets badmouthed by the ones that came before. I can remember as on the tail end of the baby boomer generation when I was starting to hit my 30s, guys in our 30s, they were going like, these Gen X people, I don't understand where they're coming from. I don't know what the world's coming to. That's the refrain every 5 or 10 years. And so I'm not willing to write off any age group just because of a label that's put on them by a previous generation that doesn't feel like that they understand them because they operate on a different value set. I will tell you one of the reasons why I'm particularly encouraged by the millennial generation is that I saw a stat the other day that indicated the percentage of women college graduates is basically at 60%. And I think what's getting mixed in more now is not so much of a generational issue, but more and more women are becoming much more of an influence in the thinking of the business world. And that's a sea change that is nothing but upside to it. And I think some of the angst among the older generations has a lot more to do with women having a much bigger representation on the way the world is being run, and male-centric point of view is getting phased out.
So let me ask you one more question. Considering your calibrated questions, one of the times that I wish I could jump out of my car and ask you a question as I'm listening to your book is when you talk about calibrated questions. Because what happens if you ask someone a calibrated question, right? Like you're having this, let's put it in context, you're having this car negotiation, and actually thanks to you, I saved about $22,000 on buying the truck that's in the parking lot right now. So thank you.
Nice.
I bought a twin turbo Ford Expedition.
All right, you got to do a short video, put it up on YouTube, laying that negotiation out, let everybody benefit from how you hit that home run.
Yeah. Oh, I'm trust me, I wish I could tell everyone in every way possible. But let's get the context of a car negotiation, right? You want to go to the dealership, you want to get the best car that you can, you know exactly what you want, and they only have two on the lot. And I love your instruction where you kind of play this role of like, I need help, can you help me? Because when you put the onus on the other person of, can you help me? It's almost this, and I know I'm preaching the choir here, it's almost this like natural human reaction to say, oh, I would love to help you. It becomes more than just your job or just some system you're rolling through or just some tactic that you've done hundreds of times. What really gets me is that when you put this calibrated question in their palm or their hands, sometimes I've seen people kind of come back with a negative response. So the calibrated question that you have is, well, I really love your 4Runners out there. They're awesome. But I can only do, 32,000. That's it. 32,000. Guy goes to his manager, plays the dancing game. They laugh at each other, pats on the back, whatever. All right. Well, I got to my manager and this is a really good deal. I got you 34,500. And I love like your reaction in the book where it's just, oh, well, I'm sure you can understand. Like, you know, I told you like 32. When I came in here, man, I was beating myself over the head. Like, I can only spend 30,000. I can only spend 30,000. If I spend too much money, I'm not going to be able to pay for my daughter's graduation ceremony, whatever. You know, I really can only do 32,000. Guy leaves and comes back. But my question is when you ask these calibrated questions of how do you expect me to do that? How do you want me to do this? What should I do? What happens if you get a negative reaction? What happens if they throw their hands up in the sky with all like their papers flinging everywhere and they just, you know, freak out on you?
All right, so let's talk about what data I have, okay?
Okay.
All right, so I would offer that we've been advising how am I supposed to do that as a question for a long time in business negotiations and with terrorists. So if I have any data, I probably have about good 15 years of interactions with terrorists where no terrorist ever got mad at us and killed a hostage on the spot. Now, we've been teaching this in business schools since 2009, so I don't have as much data there. But in the 9 years we've been advising people in business situations, that's a lot of data. And we've never had anybody throw their hands up in the air and start screaming in a business situation. So that's not a guarantee that it'll never happen. But first, let's look at what's our criteria for whether or not we're going to take a risk on something.
Okay.
That's a high enough success rate to try it. I mean, by and large, it might be the highest success rate. And let's go with Las Vegas rules. So what kind of percentage success rate do you need to be successful in Vegas?
What, 50-50?
51.
Okay.
You know, the casinos actually, I think the game that you can get closest to getting break-even odds, if you're really good at craps, you can get up to maybe 49%, which means the house is going to clean you out eventually.
Yeah.
Now, our success rates are a lot higher than that. What does happen occasionally is when somebody, you say, how am I supposed to do that? And a person on the other side says, because if you want the deal, you're going to do it. Now, let's break down as to what just happened. What just happened is you pushed them to their absolute limit. And instead of them blowing up and screaming and storming out, you've managed to push them to their complete limit and they're still at the table. And we actually teach people to keep saying it until the other side says, because if you want the deal, you're going to do it. Because your job is to test people on terms and get as good a deal as you can without making the other side so mad that they scream and walk out. So the worst possible reaction is actually kind of your goal reaction. Because as a negotiator, like I said earlier, you still got to be assertive. You just don't want to be assertive in a way where you're calling other people names or you're causing them to back away from the table. This is a way to be as assertive as possible, and everybody stays at the table.
So if they're hitting their limit point or their breaking point and they say, you know, when you ask them, you know, how do you expect me to do that? And then they respond to you because you want the deal to go through. Is that when you say it's that limit point, do you mean that that is the absolute point at which you cannot push them any further? They won't give up on that and you're going to have to break to some extent?
Well, it tells you two things. Number one, it does tell you on that term, the chances that you're going as far as you could possibly go on that term are pretty darn good. You're probably at their absolute limit. Now, your choices at this point in time are, do I want to pivot to other terms? Was this the final term I needed to lay out? As a negotiator, your job is to find the best deal possible and then make up your mind whether or not you're going to take it. Now, you may have pushed them to their absolute limit, and you're like, you know, this is still a no-go for me. This is still a bad deal. And in my company, we preach that a bad deal is worse than no deal. No deal at all is always preferable to a bad deal. So you get all the data back on all the terms, and you say, look, is this a deal I want, or are there better deals out there for me? And I'm here to tell you there are better deals out there for you if you don't want that deal.
Gotcha. And no, I think that's really powerful. So what should our listeners, or what would you challenge people to do every day to test their negotiation skills? Because, I mean, I think that you have kind of soft pitched or underhanded pitched some really important themes that, you know, in order to do this, you have to be assertive, you have to have confidence, you have to speak calmly, you have to know that you're going to do it, and you have to know that ultimately you're in control, even though you're always trying to give the premise away that the other person is in control. So how do you...
We need 2 points here.
Okay.
You want to have the upper hand. You don't want to worry about being in control.
Okay.
You're a control freak. You're really vulnerable to somebody who's going to use deference on you.
Okay.
Ridiculously vulnerable. So don't be in control. Have the upper hand. Now, the first and most important point, you said always be assertive. Empathy precedes assertion.
Okay.
If you want your empathy, or it's not empathy or assertive, it's empathy and then assertive.
Gotcha. Okay, very important distinction. So how do we practice these negotiation tactics? And at what point does it become ridiculous?
Low stakes practice for high stakes results. Like if you want to play in the Super Bowl, your first game of the season better not be the Super Bowl. You know, you want to practice. You want to, and the way you practice just in your normal everyday conversations, you learn what the skills are. You learn the mirror skill. The mirror skill is repeating the last 3 words of what someone has just said. How do you practice in low stakes conversations? Somebody calls you up on the phone and says, have you got a few minutes to talk? You say, a few minutes to talk? And you just practice your mirror skill. You're probably also going to get a download of a tremendous amount of information on that. So figure out where your low stakes conversations are, pick up the skills and start test driving them, because you're never going to be confident in them, you know, in the big, in the high stakes games, if you haven't got your low stakes practice. And we've got low stakes practice going on all day, every day.
Yeah.
You know, somebody asks you where you want to go to lunch. They got something in mind. You know, say, you know, sounds to me like you got something in mind. You know, whatever it is, figure out ways to get your low stakes practice in, and you'll get really good at this stuff really fast.
Huh. So I've recommended your book so many times on this show, and I'll recommend it again, Never Split the Difference. But if we wanted to get more from you, like, I'm thriving for more. I mean, like, after this call, I mean, I would do anything to just fly out to your office and have lunch with you to talk about what you've learned, because in my eyes, your skills are invaluable to every single human being, like, on the planet. Obviously, you don't want nefarious people to have these skills. But for every single mom who wants to start a business and has no confidence, for every dude who's been working the same job for 25 years and doesn't have the cojones to go up and start his own business because he just doesn't know if he can do it, not understanding the fact that the number one factor of owning a business is being all in, believing you can do it and never stopping. And if you're not making money, pivoting. But my point is, your information is so valuable. Where can we get more?
2 things. Buy the book on Amazon. Amazon's prices are lower than anybody else's. You go to Barnes & Noble, you're going to pay anywhere from $5 to $8 more to buy it at Barnes & Noble. Buy it on Amazon. Then, sign up. Our newsletter is free. It's short and sweet. It comes out once a week. It's called The Edge. And it's continued different ideas and application of the skills. It's only one article each week. Plus, it's a gateway to our website. And a lot of people that have read the book and love the continued update doses, a little bit Tuesday morning, a little shot of negotiation EQ every Tuesday morning, short and sweet. Best way to sign up for The Edge is to send a text, FBI Empathy, all one word. Don't let your spell check make it 2 words. Make it all one word. And send FBI Empathy to 22828. That number again is 22828. You'll get a dialogue response box back. You sign up for The Edge, you read the book, you get sharp, you go out and save $22,000 on a great vehicle.
Hey, I love my twin turbo. I'm just saying, it's a big family car and I go faster than a Porsche, and I just signed up for your newsletter too. So anyway.
All right.
Hey, Mr. Voss, thank you so much for coming on the show. I truly look up to you. I want to learn more. I may have to sign up for one of your consulting gigs because I think the knowledge and power that you have is truly, truly amazing.
Paul, that's awesome. Thank you for having me on. It's a fun conversation.
You're very welcome, sir. Thank you. All right, guys. Well, that is going to do it for us today from another episode of Ask Drone You. My name is Paul, and we'll see you next time.
We believe that videos, images, words, and sounds have the absolute power to inform, inspire, and entertain. We reject indecision, confusion, and vanity, for they work against the community. We are united under the virtues of safety and knowledge. We are a training community of learners and teachers who encourage and energize each other to achieve greatness. We are pilots, videographers, photographers, freelancers, business owners, enthusiasts, experts, and apprentices. We are creators. We are the Drone U.